Welcome to our discussion segment on Alexander the Great. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started. Hey, Joe. How's it going?
It's Friday night.
It's
a bleak, cold winter evening.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Piles of snow outside right now.
Although not as much as we kind of expected.
I expected ranges. Well, my joke to everyone was, if my roof doesn't collapse under the weight of the snow after all this hype, I'm going to feel like I've been lied to.
Agreed. So before we get into our topic, I wanted to ask you a kind of a current events topical question. What do you think about Whoopi Goldberg and her comments, historical comments about the Holocaust?
We're kind of jumping off the deep end right away, aren't we?
a little bit, but I mean, this is a history podcast. We've addressed the Holocaust and the Second World War before. Do you have any thoughts on her saying that the Holocaust was not about race?
It's outrageous. Hitler was very clear that it was about race, called the Jews a race, and everything else is very... It shows a lack of historical context, lack of any understanding in history about the time period. It was just an ignorant comment.
Yeah, I agree.
You?
Yeah, I think it illustrates the reality that for a lot of people today, they separate race and ethnicity, which is unfortunate because racial hatred and ethnic hatred are absolutely linked. And okay, yes, Jews, most Jews, not all, but most Jews do have white skin, but they are a different ethnicity, and they thus have faced all kind of oppression, just like the Irish did in the UK, the Basque on occasion in Spain. I mean, there are countless examples of people of the same race.
The Uyghurs in China.
Yeah. I mean,
right now.
Yep. There's plenty of oppression of people and by people of the same race.
Should Whoopi be fired for those comments, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so.
I don't either.
I will not get on board this whole cancel culture thing, kind of like with Joe Rogan. A lot of you are probably listening on Spotify. I don't think cancel culture does anyone any good. I think what one of my favorite quotes from Joe Rogan is, the best way to counter bad speech is with good speech and more speech. And it's probably not unique to him, but he's said that on countless occasions, and I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah, it seems like if they had just ignored the cancel culture people, which they're a very small amount, this would be over by now. Yeah. But as soon as they smell any blood in the water, it's like, all right, well, your apology isn't good enough. Mm-hmm. You're going to do that. So it's just kind of like, it's weird. It's very sad. Some of the language I've heard from specific news channels.
Quote, news or real news?
Well, yeah, it's up for debate. But like an expression I heard on... one of the news shows was, people who listen to Joe Rogan cannot be re-educated.
Oh,
so
speaking of the Holocaust.
Well, yeah, I was like, did I just hear that? And so I went back and played the clip. It's like, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
terrifying.
It is terrifying. Joy Behar said.
Oh, one of Whoopi's colleagues said that.
She said, I don't think Joe Rogan can be reformed. What does that mean?
Wow.
It's very strange. Hmm. It's very strange. So, yeah, I don't think she should be fired. I think that it was an ignorant comment. Obviously, historically inaccurate in every possible way, shape, and form. But
to our subject for today, why did you pick Alexander the Great?
Well, why not? No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. I mean, interesting character, obviously important.
Well,
why not?
And as I said in the podcast, he's one of the most interesting people in the history of the world, was able to do so many things while being extremely young comparatively.
Yeah.
And he benefited a lot from what his dad did, but he was very good in the battlefield and had a strong understanding of how to command.
And speaking of his dad, I guess that'll segue into the first question. How much of the, specifically his military innovations, you talked at the beginning of the podcast, you kind of painted the picture of one of his battles, and the whole idea of using cavalry as kind of the strike force and infantry as the hold force, the hammer and anvil technique, how much of that was his, how much of it was his dad, and how much of it was established tactics? How is he an innovator on the battlefield?
I think that he benefited from the technology and strategy that his father created, but then he tailored it. Honestly, I don't know how much of the hammer and anvil strategy was an impulse at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
because there was a tendency for him to be very rash based on everything I've read.
Yeah.
So him charging into his opponent's line at the Battle of Issus is, I don't know how planned that was. I think he saw one of his flanks starting to falter and was trying to make a decisive move early on to do something that was unexpected. So did the hammer and anvil strategy evolve? Probably. I don't know and haven't read anything where Philip used the hammer and anvil as it was named.
Okay. And on a related tactical issue, you mentioned in the Battle of Tyre where he needed a navy, that he didn't really have one. He had, what, about 80 ships compared to the Tyrians who had several hundred? Did I get those numbers right?
So I don't know how much he prioritized his navy over his army. And so when he got to Tyre, there's this challenge now that, okay, this has a massive seaport. How do I take this? And it also has high walls.
Mm-hmm.
So
and it's off the coast. It's an island.
Yeah. Right, right. And so it kind of got a little precarious there for a while until he realized, wait a minute, I have conquered these specific areas that do have ships. Okay, let's set up a blockade here.
Mm-hmm. And then build a giant bridge with siege towers on it.
Right.
And go out to the... Let's talk about a little bit about his childhood. His horse, Bucephalus, was that the same horse that he had throughout his entire career? I don't know the lifespan of horses.
Yeah, so he had that horse up until India.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's the horse, actually, now that I'm remembering, that's the horse that he built a giant tomb to and named like a whole city after. Is that right?
Obviously, he honored that horse. That horse somehow survived every single engagement up to that point. It had a tomb. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, interesting. And then you talked about him being tutored by Aristotle. What were the kind of the Greek influences on his life and his education, and then in how he ruled? Because it seemed like he was much more of a Macedonian, kind of a non-Greek, what they would call a barbarian mindset. Very passionate, very focused on his emotions. Not so much governing based on reason. Certainly after he had won his victory over the Persian Empire, he basically becomes a megalomaniac. So where do we see the Greek influences on him as a man?
That's a great question. I think you see, if we were going to call it a barbarian mindset, you see that honed and focused through that Greek influence.
Mm.
The things I've read have said that it focused him. So not all the time, but it allowed him to really hone in on the things that absolutely had to be done in the moment.
Okay. It's an interesting question, kind of almost a what if. There's no footwear nearby for you to throw at me, so I'm going to ask you this question. Do you think his life and his career would have been different if he had been taught by Plato instead of Aristotle?
I think he would have been a little bit more reserved, but overall, no.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because he was who he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was.
So his education did not make him who he was.
I think it influenced who he was. But okay. I it seemed like from childhood on, he was very driven. He was very focused. He's very bold. Mm. Bold is the word I would use.
Okay.
And that's why in the podcast, I was trying to figure out an analogy, like when you're crafting something, if it's too hot, if you're too aggressive, it's not going to last.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, in essence, how he was.
Would you say that it was his father who influenced him more than anybody else?
Yeah.
So let's talk about Philip II. I know we did a podcast on him, but just very briefly, for those who maybe have not heard that one, can you give us kind of the highlights of Alexander and his dad's relationship? Because it was very troubled, ultimately, leading up to Philip's death. And there was some speculation by historians that he may have been involved in his dad's death.
I would say it was contentious for sure. Mm-hmm. They were both very powerful personalities. So while it had its moments of challenges, I think that there was a trust there, and that trust was based off of expectation.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I think that if Philip had stayed alive, if he had not been assassinated, I have to wonder how Persian conquest would have looked and if it would have progressed and lasted longer.
Hmm. Do you know if Alexander had kind of his own, almost a power base? Could he have challenged Philip for the throne, or did he have to wait until his father was gone? How popular was he while Philip was alive with the people of Macedonia and Greece?
I don't think he could have challenged him.
You don't think so?
No. I think that Philip was a force. Everything that he had accomplished during his reign was something that people were aware of.
Okay.
So it was less about support and more about, oh my gosh, this person has forced Greece to unify under his flag. Mm-hmm. So if Alexander challenged him, people wouldn't probably have taken him as seriously.
Yeah.
Because of that. It's like, well, he's done all this. What have you done?
So Philip dies. Alexander becomes king, and he leaves to go on conquest. Is his mother left in charge at Pella as regent, or who rules Macedonia while he's out conquering?
He appointed a regent in charge named Andy Potter.
Oh, interesting. Tell us a little bit about his generals, because Alexander didn't command the army alone. He obviously surrounded himself with well-trained men that he trusted and that would follow his orders. Do you know anything about whether it's Antiochus or Seleucus or Ptolemy or Hephaestion or any of those guys?
To your point, he trusted them immensely. Mm-hmm. I think of the example when they're in India and his soldiers are complaining about wanting to go home. It was his generals who were very clear, like, you can push forward, but these men are done. Mm-hmm. Like, if you continue to do this, we will start to lose. It's not worth the price that will be paid for gaining any further miles here.
Okay.
So that to me is enough to say, okay, he had a dialogue that was ongoing and it was based on trust. His expectations of his generals were extremely high. Mm-hmm. Every general was in charge of his part of the army. And,
did each one command a phalanx? Or
yes.
How did that? Okay.
Yeah. The challenge was as they're traversing all of this land, how to keep, you know, your pikes in order, your armor in order, your cavalry in order, all those things. And mm-hmm. that was his expectation. So given the supply lines from Greece were not
getting further
possible.
And further away. Yeah.
So it was very much up to the generals to make sure that each of their parts of the army was outfitted, healthy, rested, and so on. Alexander expected open lines of communication from his generals about the condition of each horse, each soldier. There were times that he would hold back an attack if he thought, okay, I'm unsure if there's an illness happening, if this was going to affect how we could advance in a certain way. So there was a dependency on them. He wasn't trying to be a one-man show. His generals respected him immensely. Mm-hmm. When you win so many times and you have so many accomplishments, I mean, you can't help but do that.
Okay, that makes sense. So we talked about his generals, talked about his kind of his style of leadership. Let's talk about his battles. You placed a lot of emphasis on the Battle of Issus. Why that and not Gaugamela? Because most histories of Alexander really emphasize Gaugamela as the turning point in his war against Persia. So I'm curious, what stood out to you about the Battle of Issus more than Gaugamela?
Whatever he did at Issus, his attack pattern, his drive, how he conducted himself and his army in that engagement caused Darius to flee. It was the first time that he engaged the Persian army with the ruler on the field. And okay. I think that the way that he did it, how he conducted himself, his advance of his army caused Darius to flee. That mm-hmm. was something that all of the soldiers saw, and it started a trend that continued onward.
Okay.
So I think that was a perception change overall that followed Darius around, because some of those soldiers did survive, and that story continued on. Like Alexander the Great, this kid from Greece, has caused the ruler of Persia to run away. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was actually the first point of everything starting to fall. Because that loss of morale, I mean, imagine being in the battle lines and seeing your leader run away and actually be chased off of the field. So that's why I really emphasize that. You know, obviously, when we think about the timeline, Gaugamela is very important, but this set the stage for that battle.
Okay. And after Issus, that's basically what opens up the Middle East to him, correct?
Yeah.
So it's just straight. It's a straight shot down the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. He takes Tyre. He takes Jerusalem, bypasses Jerusalem, doesn't destroy it.
He does not.
Interesting. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I do. So what happened was he got to the gates and was invited in, and he was shown the passage in Daniel where it talks about the ram and the goat. Mm. And basically, it talks about the ram going across Asia and conquering all of Asia, and then the horn breaks and four horns come up. He perceived that to be himself, And as a result of this thing that he believed, he said, I will not attack you. They did not attack him.
Right.
So it was very much like an invite to come in and see this passage. And so he does.
So he gets to Egypt, overthrows the last Egyptian pharaoh, the last independent pharaoh who will rule.
Yeah. There was a fight that happened, but it wasn't a real one.
Yeah. Didn't the Egyptian people rise and say, yeah, we'll take him over our tyrant dictator? It's interesting that I think, if memory serves, from 331 BC or thereabouts, when Alexander conquered Egypt, until what, 1947 AD, the Egyptian people hadn't ruled themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty close. I mean, they've been, they were under the Greeks, then the Romans, then the Arabs, and then the Ottomans, and then the British. I mean, it was almost more than two centuries of Egyptian subjugation until the British finally let him go after World War II. Was that, do you think, the point where he started down his path of megalomania, when they declared him to be a god, as he's looking at this, like, the oldest country in the world with the pyramids and the palaces and the statuary and everything, and they're all hailing him as a god? Do you think that's the point where he kind of went from this kind of semi-rational barbarian into full-on, I am a god on this earth?
I think that he was always that way to a certain extent. When they got in Asia Minor, the first thing that he did getting off the ship was throw his spear into the sand and thank the gods for this gift of Asia. So I think that there was always that side. And as he conquered and as he won, if you're asking specifically, was Egypt the moment where he believed himself to be a god? I think that what he perceived was the confirmation of his ego each time, and it got bigger and so on. And so it could have been, but I think that there was always a sense of that he was that way. Now, part of it, I think, not linked to ego, is he didn't come in and just slaughter everybody. It was always, unless you attacked him specifically.
Right, like Tyre, for example. Tyre,
and Thebes. I mean, Thebes fought back.
Early on, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was not going to just come in and burn everything and slaughter everyone.
Mm-hmm.
There was an awareness there of like, okay, what is the easiest way to accomplish my goal? It is not to come in and cause everyone to hate me. It is to come in and influence everyone in a way that they will love me or best see me as a god.
Yeah. Okay. And then that perception, so-called, gets confirmed about a year later when he's marching into Babylon.
Yeah.
And the largest, most historic city in the world to that point, the population is hailing him and, you know, throwing flowers and celebrating his arrival. Then he takes Susa and Persepolis and all the other countries and all the other cities of the Persian Empire. Was his triumph ever in doubt? Is there any way, do you think, that the Persians could have stopped him?
Yeah. Yeah,
really?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I think about the Battle of Issus, he was Darius had more soldiers on the field than he did.
But that was most battles, wasn't it?
Yeah, that battle fascinates me because he had so many more.
Hmm.
He could have easily encircled.
What were the numbers? I don't remember off the top of my head.
37,000, and Darius's army was twice that or more.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it seemed like it was, I don't want to say a lost cause, it's not, but they could have beaten him. There was not, however, that drive to do so. They were not as hungry as Alexander was.
Okay.
And that's a simple way to say it, but there was something different about Alexander driving his cavalry directly into the Persian line, breaking that line, causing that chaos, and then circling around and going straight at their leader. That wasn't common.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that, I mean, it had been done before, but it was very rare. Instead of turning to face Alexander, Darius ran away.
Right.
And so you have this route and so on. So I think what would have happened if Darius hadn't run? What if he had turned his chariot around and charged straight at him?
Mm-hmm.
If he had died, fine, but he would have died fighting back, not running away. Would that have kept his troops in place to avenge him? Maybe. So I think that the tone was set by that first encounter between Darius and Alexander, and then that tone continued on.
Okay. A lot of media portrayals, not just the movie that we shall not speak of, but other...
Well, I don't know that a lot of people have seen it.
So. No, that's true. But other portrayals of the Persians, specifically, think of 300, things like that. they portray it as kind of just this rabble, this mass of soldiers who don't really have any sense of discipline or order or anything like that, compared to the Greeks who are all in perfect formation using the sarissa or using their spears, things like that. Is that an accurate portrayal, or did the Persians have the exact same kind of military discipline and they just fought differently? They had a different tactics.
The latter, yeah.
They conquered most of the world.
Yeah, I mean, they had an empire for a reason. Yeah. They were very good at fighting.
Okay, so it wasn't the soldiers, it was the leadership, you would say, was the reason for...
I mean, Persia almost conquered Greece,
yeah,
like a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And they did that because they knew how to fight. So it was... It was an amazing thing that Greece was able to hold out and fight back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So once he takes down the Persian Empire, Darius dies. What happens to the man who betrayed Darius?
He's killed. Alexander does not look very highly upon the assassin at all. When Darius is murdered, he sends...
It was by his cousin, wasn't it? Right, or a member of his family
he sends Darius back with honors to be buried.
Alexander does.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. The person responsible for killing Darius is put to a gruesome death as a result of that. He's hunted and killed.
So Alexander respected Darius, even though they were enemies on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Okay. What does that say about Alexander as a man?
You know, that's a great question, because you would think because Alexander chased him off the battlefield a couple of times, he would have no respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, after Issus, he found his wife and his daughters and treated them very well. In fact, he married one of Darius's daughters in the process. He treated them very well. He respected them. I think that there was still that respect that was present. And you were asking earlier about what was the Greek influence. Mm-hmm. I think that is an influence.
Yeah. And then he keeps going. He makes it all the way to the Hindu Kush, and it's... Depending on the history that you read, it's either the weather and the climate, or it's the resistance of the natives, or it's new diseases, and it's the terrain. What do you think was the deciding factor in Alexander stopping at the borders of what is today India and Pakistan?
So I think it's a combination of things. I think that his supply chain was cut a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that there was the reality that while he was still conquering territory, was he able to replenish his supplies and keep his army supplied and armored and so on to continue on? I think within the new region, to your point, there was a lot of illnesses that were not present before. And I think finally, I do believe that his army was tired.
Mm.
I mean, what is our end here? When does this stop? Alexander could have pushed them to keep going. I think that was obviously his preference, but he didn't want to do it at the expense of his army.
Yeah.
Which also says something else about him. It wasn't necessarily, I mean, it was totally all about him, but also it wasn't at the same time. Like, he realized we've reached a limit here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a combination of things, as it generally is. And is there a sense that Alexander was tired of continuing onward? I'm not sure. I've heard some...
He wept when there were no worlds.
I don't think that's a true... I don't think that he actually did.
You don't think so?
No, because he knew that there was more.
Are you suggesting that the Romans occasionally embellished their stories of history?
Imagine that.
How dare you, sir?
Absolutely. Yeah, he knew that there were more cities, there were more lands. He did not know how far he was to the what was considered end of the world.
Yeah.
And I think something about his travels back to Babylon reinforced maybe we need to consolidate here, because he started to pass through territories that he had left others in charge of who were abusing that power and so on. So he realized, okay,
then he starts making examples of them.
Right, exactly.
So he gets back to Babylon, and that's where he dies.
Right.
We don't know, correct, exactly how he died.
There is speculation that it was Guillain-Barré syndrome. I believe that's how you say it.
Yeah. How would they know that?
His symptoms at the time was he was unable to move. He could blink his eyes. He could not speak. No one knows, right?
Yeah.
But based on the symptoms, that's what people have speculated. They couldn't do anything for him. They thought he was dead for a while, and then he would open his eyes and blink in answer to certain things. But he couldn't do anything at all. He couldn't move.
What happened to his body?
So after Alexander died, his body was buried in Memphis by Ptolemy. Hammered
near Graceland?
Casket. Huh?
Near Graceland?
No. Anyway,
come on.
It was a hammer.
That was at least a little bit funny.
Yeah, it was a little funny. All right. In this coffin of hammered gold. Okay. Then he was transferred to Alexandria, where he was reburied. The tomb is not, no one can find it after that. It was lost in history.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was sought after by the Romans, though.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. But yeah, it was lost.
Okay. His empire is then divided among the, is it 26 top generals, 23, something like that?
I read it was the like three or four.
Well, it ultimately is consolidated into three or four, but if memory serves, all of the generals got something.
I don't know that they were given like ruler status. I think that they were given rewards in terms of land and regions, but in terms of the management of the empire, it was between his three to four top generals.
Okay. And how did that go?
It went very badly. Yeah. It collapsed. It did not last very long.
Is there any way, again, it's speculation, is there any way that those three kingdoms could have resisted the growing power of Rome? Is there any way that we keep a Latin West and a Greek East? Or is there the fact that they're disunited now, does that mean eventually Rome is going to take over?
Purely Joe Parker opinion, I don't think so. Okay. I think there needed to be one ruler. There needed to be one system that governed the entire territory. Whatever that system was, it needed to be a unified front.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I skipped over something early on, and it just came to me, and I think we got a comment on Spotify. Since you've got it pulled up, why don't you read, because we did get an audience member comment. And again, people, we love hearing from you. So
please send
us questions. Facebook, we've got, I think Spotify is back up. We've nailed or ironed out the tech issues. We're checking our emails. But anyway, Joe, go ahead and read us our comment.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got a comment that said, I love the Gordian knot story. Very funny. It reminded me of the Kobayashi Maru and how Captain Kirk cheated to win. I guess I did not realize.
A Star Trek fan is also a fan of 15 Minute History. Excellent.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely excellent. I guess I did not realize that he was Greek. I pictured him a Roman. So.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I've run into that too, where people instinctively think, and I think the association of conquering to Rome is very natural. So it's not something that's new to me. But yeah, I love the Gordian knot story. In fact, we always have outtakes. But I actually, when we were recording
the episode, right?
I stopped for a minute and just started just cracking up, because that, to me, I was sharing with John, that's how I feel about escape rooms. I've done the escape rooms before. And so they close the door and it's like, okay, you're timed. Here's all these things that you need to do. It's like, all right. It's like, all right, find your way. I was like, can somebody kick the door in? Because that's the way out. This everyone's running all over the room trying to find clues.
It's a game. You got to play the game, man.
You know what? It's interesting. That's what they told me. Yeah. Like, Joe, come on. I'm like, well, there's the exit. Let's kick the door. So I love that story.
Joe smokes in a shotgun and shoots the door open.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, so I think that the Gordian knot story is very reflective. Now, some people say it's not real. Yeah. Like it may have happened or not, but very reflective of his demeanor. It's like, all right, I'll untie the knot, but I'm not going to do it in a complicated way.
Yeah.
You didn't specify how you wanted it untied, so I'm just going to untie it my way.
Yep.
That's how he did everything.
And it's also Captain Kirk. And since Star Trek was brought up very briefly, Joe, I have one question for you. Who is the greatest captain in the history of Star Trek?
And
has nothing to do with Alexander the Great.
No, not at all.
Whoever sent us in that comment, thank you for doing that.
You asked for it. So here we go.
The opportunity to ask Joe this very crucial question.
It is a crucial one. I love Captain Kirk's approach. I love Jean-Luc Picard's demeanor, his application of logic and calm diplomacy.
This new Picard that we're getting right now?
Actual Picard on the old show. So I love how bold Kirk is. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to diplomacy, that for the Picard character is so cool. Mm. How he can navigate specific challenges in a way that is very logical. He's usually pretty calm.
Unlike Alexander the Great. There's our historical tie-in.
Yeah. But my favorite scene, sorry.
Yeah.
My favorite scene of any Star Trek film is when it's in the Wrath of Khan, when they're on the planet Genesis, where the Genesis thing has been tested and all that. And they learn about how Kirk did beat this simulation. And Kirk says, I don't believe in a no-win scenario. Mm. I don't like to lose. I agree with him.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. That is the quintessential moment defining Captain Kirk.
That's an excellent non-answer. So let me ask you the same question that Ben Wyatt asked people in Parks and Rec. When it comes down to it, who do you want in charge of your Sovereign class starship? James T. Kirk or Jean-Luc Picard?
I hate you so much.
Or Ben Sisko.
Why don't I answer
or
your question
any of the other ones?
Why don't I answer your question with a question? No, I'm going to go with Picard.
Picard?
Yeah. Okay. How about you? How about you?
Sisko, hands down.
Okay.
He will do whatever is necessary to protect himself, to protect his family, his friends, his country. If you're in a leadership position where lives are at stake, that's what you want to go with.
Yeah, I remember.
Deep Space Nine is such an underrated Star Trek series.
Best space battles.
Oh yeah,
of all time.
Yeah, but what about Star Wars, Joe?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, excellent question. Thank you.
The benefit of audience interaction is you get to see this
exactly.
other side of us.
Yeah. Send us more pop culture references. We'll answer your questions.
As a reminder, the new format is to accommodate audience interaction. Yep. We want you to interact. So make comments, make jokes, insult me, insult John.
Don't insult me.
Yeah.
I will find you.
Please insult John. I'm just kidding.
And what's the email address, Joe, where they can send us their comments?
15minutehistory@gmail.com.
It's not 15-Minute History Podcast. I think I've told several people that. I apologize here and now in front of everyone.
And you're biased, too.
That, too. I am. Two final questions. One, in a religious history course when I was in college, my professor described how Alexander the Great and his actions paved the way for the rise of Christianity. Give me your take on how Christianity was influenced by the fact that Alexander lived the life he did the things he did.
I don't know what your professor said, so I'll do
my
best.
I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so obviously his conquering of the known world at the time spread Greek culture and Greek thought. That's the biggest influence, is that without that influence there, would Rome have been able to rise to its height? That's my answer. It's probably not as good as your
professor. That's interesting. Yes, it's not what he said, but that's okay.
Okay.
Just because he had 4 PhDs and, you know, whatever. Kind of alongside that, he had two answers to that. First, in order to have Jesus survive his first controversial statement, you have to have Greek culture. If the Persians had been in charge of Judea when Jesus arose, the first time he said that he is the Son of God, they would have said, okay, he's a crazy person, let's kill him. The second one is that in order for Christianity to spread as quickly as it does, you have to have one language. And the fact that Alexander conquered, he spread specifically Koine Greek, which is the Greek that St. Paul spoke and other early missionaries spoke. He's able to talk to people from across the Greek-speaking eastern half of the Roman Empire, which is where most of the early, you know, first, second century Jewish missionaries spoke, or where they worked.
So if we were to break this down, if the professor and I were talking, he and I would be in agreement. He was just more specific.
Yes.
Okay. Just so yeah. we're clear. Okay. Just yes. so we're clear.
As I said, kind of along the same lines. Okay. All right. Final question. If you could boil everything that Alexander the Great lived, everything he embodied, everything he did into one lesson for leaders, because I think we can all agree, regardless of your political views, economic views, views on history, Alexander the Great was a tremendous leader. What single lesson of leadership could you draw specifically from Alexander? That's not also true of other great conquerors of the past.
Fortune favors the bold.
Ah, yes.
Fortune favors the bold in so many ways. There is a reality of conceptualizing something and doing something.
Mm.
Being able to learn from what you're doing is much different in the eyes of those who follow you than being able to talk about what you would like to do.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander did it. He really did it.
Yes.
And was he perfect as a commander? Absolutely not. Did he have screw-ups? Absolutely. Did he realize that there were things that were wrong? Yes. How did he compensate? He surrounded himself with capable people, and he put his trust in them. They were aligned in the boldness until they weren't. They were as bold as he was until they weren't. And then when they weren't, he paid attention to them.
Mm.
And he said, okay, we're done.
Hmm. Quick nerd moment. Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Season 6, Episode 5 is called Favor the Bold. Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Alexander the Great. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. And if you would like to help us make this podcast even better, you can go to 15minutehistorypodcast.org and click the support button. And again, send us your questions, comments, complaints, concerns, snide remarks, anything. We love hearing from our audience. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.